Stats in a Wrap, the podcast series from Eurostat.
Wiem, że jest kilka takich NGO i polityki.
Informacjoni devono essere prima.
Vai alik, te ha sille parast etsa.
Ja hunavam ja kapsi.
Facts are facts.
Welcome to Stats in a Wrap, the podcast all about statistics from Eurostat, the statistical office of the European Union. Today in the Wrapped Cafe, we're in political mood and contemplating the meaning of truth. Do you trust what you read in the media? Do you trust your elected political representatives to always tell the truth? And what do you do if you want to check the truth of their claims? This is a bumper year for elections. We've just had the Indian poll with nearly a billion people eligible to cast their ballots. There's the European parliamentary vote, just gone, of course, and everyone knows Americans will choose their president in November. But there are also democratic mandates being sought in Algeria, Ghana, Mauritius, Namibia, Chile, Jordan, Georgia, and Lithuania. In fact, there are 64 major elections globally in 2024, and by some estimates, nearly half the world's voters will have chosen their political representatives before the year is out. Informed debate has never been so important, but the job of informing debates with accurate reporting and balanced analysis is a tough one. As never before, journalists have to battle with disinformation and misinformation online as voters try to get to grips with the issues that affect them. The mainstream media and the professionals of fact-checking organisations are fighting back, and of course supporting them are the official statistics bodies whose lifeblood is accuracy. To help us understand the world of political misinformation, news reporting, fact-checking, and the work of official statisticians, we have four highly qualified individuals in the Wrapped Cafe today. Paweł Terpilowski is chief editor of the Polish fact-checking organisation Demagog and a governing board member of the European Fact-Checking Standards Network. Welcome, Paweł.
Hi, Jonathan. Thanks for having me.
And we have Kirsten Hansel, who is Head of Communication Strategy and Social Media at DeStatis, the German Federal Statistical Office. Welcome, Kirsten.
Hi, thank you for the invitation.
And from Eurostat, we have our very own Dean Vuletic, an Information and Communications Officer. Welcome, Dean.
Thank you, Jonathan. It's a pleasure to be here.
And last but by no means least is Francis Elliott, who has kindly volunteered to share his experience with us today. Francis has been immersed in British politics the whole of his professional life and was for 8 years until 2021 the political editor of The Times, so knows a thing or two about elections and political coverage, and had a ringside seat at the political theatre of the Brexit vote and its aftermath and the onset of the COVID pandemic, both not exactly free of misinformation. He also happens to be my brother and still agreed to come on the show. Welcome, Francis.
Jonathan, hi, how are you?
Wonderful to have you here. I'm sure it's going to be great fun. Let me just dive in first of all with Paweł. Paweł, tell us what fact-checking is. It's a lot more than those two simple words, and it seems to have developed into a major professional field. So just give us a working definition of fact-checking. What is it?
Thanks, Jonathan. First of all, I would like to agree with you that those words are very simple in a way, and this fact-checking is at the same time very simple and also complicated work, to be honest. At the bottom of it, it's only about verifying facts and fact-checking if the information is true or wrong based on credible sources. We are dealing with an ever-increasing amount of misinformation and disinformation that is happening all around the internet and also on the media. We are also seeing the increasing level of mistrust towards legitimate media, towards mainstream media, towards legacy media, and that's where people are starting to turn their information consumption from social media platforms to other sources of information, and that's where fact-checking is really coming into place.
So on that subject, tell us a bit about Demagog and how you work. You obviously have a team behind you, and you're part of the founding leadership, so perhaps just tell us a little bit about Demagog and how it works.
Demagog is the first Polish fact-checking organization, started in 2014, and we started working strictly focusing on political fact-checking. We fact-checked political claims and also fact-checked promises made by politicians to basically set up an environment, that an organization that somewhat keeps the politicians accountable for their work and for the things that they are saying.
How do you actually reach people to correct their misapprehensions about something, say, like COVID vaccines, or expose or debunk myths about immigration? Because presumably most people who use social media don't also then check the demagogue website to see whether they've seen something that's correct or not. How do everyday people encounter demagogue in Poland?
We cooperate with social media platforms like Meta and TikTok in order to actually provide the information, the credible information, our content to the users on those platforms. When you experience a misinformation that we are fact-checking on Facebook, for instance, there is a label that links to our article. You can read it, learn about why this particular piece of information is false or manipulative or partly false. We are also trying to promote media literacy among all various groups in our society in order to build strong misinformation resilience. It's not only about fact-checking, it's not only about debunking, it's also about critical thinking. We have to be vigilant, we have to stay focused, we have to stay critical. And basically our goal is that everyone can become a fact-checker and everyone should be a fact-checker in their own lives.
Our society is living faster and faster. The news are changing all the time. And in the world of social media, TikTok, Instagram and co., you have many unverified information that are just provided and people believe in that.
Kirsten, let me come to you. You're at Germany's official statistics organization, Destatis. And just like Pavel, obviously, you're seeing a lot of information, traffic, conversations, dialogue, sort of chat on social media. It's not the traditional role for official statistics bodies to get involved in that kind of world of informal dialogue between individuals chatting about what's going on in the world of politics and news. But you are getting closer to that. Just tell us a little bit about how Destatis is engaging, particularly with social media.
You're totally right. It's not the way of communication that we were used to over decades. In former times, up to the year 2000, we mostly published our data and we defined ourselves as data providers. And nowadays, it's true, we totally have to set up a new way how we communicate our data. And this is very much in line, as Pavel said, the need to help people understand our data, to put data in the right context, to explain methodology, to answer questions in case of misunderstanding.
Just explain to us a little bit about what happened during COVID-19 at Destatis. How did that impact your understanding of misinformation and disinformation? Did it sort of signal a sea change? And did you then start to rethink because of COVID-19?
We were all very much influenced by what happened during COVID-19. Yeah. And I guess nearly every part of civil society, of institutions, we all had to realize that how important data is and reliable data is, and as well how we as official institutions have to deal and have to communicate our data. And I guess in Germany, in particular, for us, it was the first time that we were confronted with distrust. I mean, disinformation, we never really had a problem with, based on misunderstandings or wrong interpretation of statistics or these cases. And then all these discussions about the reliability and the truth of data came up during COVID. At that time, we started to realize that it is not only necessary to have reliable data. Of course, this is the basis, but it is also very, very important that you open up and do not close your communication. You have to open up. You have to explain complexity. And you really have to help people understand that statistics sometimes only is a way to approach to truth and that it's not truth in itself. And there can be mistakes in statistics as well. This was our lesson learned, and this is what we now try to integrate in our daily communication on social media.
The issue of trust is fascinating. We know in public attitude surveys that trust has declined in traditional media. It's declined in government. And there persists the illusion among some people that statistical institutes like yours are actually an arm of government, that you're not independent, that you take orders from government politicians. Do you find that? I mean, has that been your experience, that you actually have to keep telling people, no, we are the awkward people who publish statistics when we know it's right and we don't take our instructions from politicians? How does that stack up? Is that what you find?
Yes, indeed. This is what we're confronted with from time to time, that we are only part of the system. Denying it and telling we are politically independent doesn't help that much, because if people do not trust in your institution, you won't really succeed by convincing them, but you can trust us. What we think is that it's more important to behave trustworthy in a trustworthy way. And that means not that much telling that you're trustworthy, but open up, show transparently what you're calculating, show the options and the limits that statistics offer for decision making, and talk about data and be open for dialogue.
Dean, if I could bring you in here, Eurostat, like Destatis, has its unique selling point, reliability and independence. And one of your briefs at Eurostat has been monitoring and ensuring quality. Could you just set out for us why this thing, quality, is so important to maintain trust and independence in statistical organisations? And how do you go about maintaining it?
Well, quality is crucial for maintaining trust and independence in statistical organizations because it ensures the reliability, accuracy, and credibility of the data. High-quality statistics are fundamental for informed decision-making by governments, businesses, and the public. And when users have confidence in the data, they can trust that policies and analyses based on this data are sound and effective. Eurostat maintains quality in its statistics through a robust framework that accompanies several key components. There's this European Statistics Code of Practice, which outlines principles such as professional independence, impartiality and objectivity, and sound methodology. Eurostat implements the Code of Practice through a quality assurance framework that represents a collection of methods, tools, and good practices. And then there are peer reviews that evaluate and enhance the quality of statistics produced by both Eurostat and the National Statistical Institute.
There is quite a lot of pressure on newspaper organizations to put out a lot of news in a very timely manner, which makes it kind of difficult to do enough, especially in times where we are flooded with potentially false and generated media. So I would say the newspaper organizations might lag a little bit behind its times.
I'd like to bring in Francis now. You've sat through Brexit, you saw the COVID-19 pandemic kick off, and the threat that that brought to the British National Health Service, the NHS, always a political football. You've had to report the politics of very many different issues in public life. But fact-checking as an activity has increased over the years. And I'm just wondering to what extent that's impacted your work and the work of your colleagues. And does it help you or hinder you? I mean, is fact-checking even relevant to the mainstream media?
Well, I'll let you into a secret. Most journalists are absolutely terrified of any stories with a number in it. We are, by selection, words people, not numbers people, and many of us are borderline enumerate. So to start with full disclosure, I feel slightly nervous being in an online room with statisticians, but you know, I'm sure you'll let me out of here alive. The confessions don't stop there. I mean, you know, I've made some bad mistakes with numbers in my career. It's really awkward, and if I could bring a sort of journalist perspective to this, we don't set out to be wrong on the whole, and it's always embarrassing when we are. The kind of rise of the fact checker is, to my mind, just a good thing. And in the UK, we have a couple of organisations like Pavel's. We also have the BBC, which has just recently started investing quite significant amounts of money in something called BBC Verify. Brexit and COVID, I think, was a hugely conditioning kind of experience. Brexit was brutal trading of partial half-true statistics, the most famous of which is probably that £350 million is sent to the EU every week that could alternatively be spent on the NHS, and that didn't account for the fact that some money was sent back in rebates, so it was a gross, not net figure. Fairly straightforward, simple lie, some would say. Because it assumed itself, it was almost like a meta story. The more that the opponents screamed about the fact that this was a wrong figure, they ended up just amplifying the original figure. You actually get rewarded for poor behaviour.
Yes, indeed. There's that saying, isn't there, that a lie has travelled twice around the world before the truth has got it.
The truth gets its boots on. Yeah.
Boots on. I think it was coined in the 19th century. So it's sort of, I find that somewhat reassuring.
And what really shocked me the other day was even after people have been shown that something is wrong, they still have a more negative opinion. So you say something false about you, and then it's demonstrated as false, but it doesn't reset 100%. It's back to 95%.
The years have passed. We understand that a lot of fact-checking is not even... It's political, so it's based on whatever the person who's fact-checking is doing, what their political view is.
I'm not sure if those organizations are independent. There's always issue of funding and so on. I believe there is a lot of honest effort there to be independent. But at the same time, I think it's finally we need to, as a humanity, admit that there is no objectivity outside any opinion, outside any ideology.
One of the interesting things you were talking about, Francis, was how disinformation, once it's out there, is hard to correct. It has a sort of zombie life, even after you've killed it with the facts. There it is, carrying on. Pavel, can you just help us out here with this extraordinary approach to countering disinformation with something called pre-bunking? People have actually used the metaphor of an inoculation against the viral spread of disinformation. Tell us a bit about what pre-bunking is and how it works in protecting people from disinformation or giving them a perspective that allows them to sort of not be that impressed by it. Can you just talk us through pre-bunking?
Pre-bunking is our efforts of trying to prevent the misinformation from happening in the first place. Like, we're trying to basically vaccinate people for disinformation or for misinformation, analyzing the trends, analyzing the narratives, analyzing what we are predicting may become important, may become relevant in the public discourse for the upcoming weeks or months, especially during the periods like elections. And when we are doing this, we can actually somehow predict the, you know, false narratives that may arise or may amplify themselves via the use of political actors and other actors. And then we are basically trying to provide the information before the disinformation takes place and provide, you know, trying to assess what people are actually interested in. What are the questions that we need to answer for them?
I've seen some extremely polished, well-made videos that Demagogue made with the support of the Google Jigsaw project, and they were directly pre-bunking disinformation, in this case about Ukrainian refugees coming to Poland. Can you just talk us through some of the examples of how pre-bunking has worked in a real-life context at Demagogue?
Yes, this campaign that we did with Jigsaw was before the Polish parliamentary elections. And there were huge concerns and narratives around undermining the integrity of elections, credibility of the elections. And one of the main driving narratives that we've observed was that people were starting to believing or starting to spread information that Ukrainian refugees coming to Poland from the Ukraine, escaping from the war, will actually be eligible to vote in those elections and thus will manipulate the outcome. The elections will become a great fraud. And we knew that those narratives were based on some information that were manipulated, but otherwise they were true. For instance, that Ukrainians were getting their PESEL numbers, which is like ID number in Poland that you need to have in order to attend any formal business or social security, etc., etc. No way this can translate into being eligible to vote because you don't have citizenship. So this was quite obvious and quite easy narrative to debunk or pre-bunk in that regard.
I would expect it did work, but were you able to measure how much or whether it worked? I mean, they're very persuasive, short videos, really quite easy to take in and understand, and they're very engaging. But do you think they actually worked?
I think it's hard to measure it, quite frankly. Like, we don't have still enough capacity to actually measure the, you know, effectiveness. We have other issues in Polish-Ukrainian relations that can actually influence the Polish perception of Ukrainians. And this is actually happening right now. So we are seeing the decrease of support towards Ukraine and towards the EU in general in Poland because of the political issues, because of the issues with the European Green Deal, agriculture issues, the imports of agricultural products from Ukraine, you know, grain issue that we had in Poland. So those are the, you know, factors that come in to the very complicated situation that makes the overall assessment of such campaigns quite hard to quantify.
in the European election, for sure, people could spread misinformation because it's like personal interests, I guess. It's difficult to judge.
I talked a little bit earlier about the fact that we're in a bumper year for elections. Nearly half the world's voters are going to the polls. Kirsten, I have to ask you, we've had the European parliamentary elections and you've got three state elections in Germany in September coming up. Do you find that there are hot button issues at election time that trigger statistical claims and then you have to sort of step in and put the record straight, so to speak?
In terms of disinformation, it's always about climate change, about migration, about gender pay gap. But it's not different from what is going on in general.
How do you manage at the Status to appear independent when debates heat up and you're facing different claims and counterclaims and arguments where people are claiming that right is on their side and they've got all the facts? Do you have to put information out there that clarifies these debates at election times?
We do not change our dissemination habits. This is one part of the political neutrality. We cannot avoid talking about issues and we cannot start talking about special issues around elections. We always release the data if new data is available. So this is part of our political neutrality, that we are not focusing on which data is now needed to prepare the elections or discussions around elections, because the data themselves can be very political if you release them at different days or different occasions.
I think normally journalists just want to have the scoop, to have the last information, so they maybe sometimes they don't really care about if the information is real or not, or maybe if it's really accurate. So they just want to tell the scoop and then maybe they check later online.
Francis, when you're gearing up for an election in the UK, a national election, what was the atmosphere like in your team? How did it change? Did it feel like you're all jockeys kind of waiting for the start of a race? Or how did your work change in terms of handling contested facts and having to deal with people ringing you up at all hours, half bullying you, half manipulating you? How did you handle all of that?
How does it change? I mean, it just does become a lot more tense. And, you know, you're not just within the teams and you know that this is your kind of moment. Your coverage of these 3 to 4 weeks is going to be how you are judged by your bosses. It's also tense between the different party. As political editor, I would get shouted at pretty much every night when the paper dropped by one or the other of the main parties in the UK, and I considered it a badge of honour if that happened, and I want to be shouted at by both of them. But it didn't make for a pleasant period. It's not kind of, well,
yes, I mean, if you're annoying both sides at the same time, you can be pretty sure you're getting it right, can't you?
I took particular pleasure if they were annoyed because I had not fallen for some obvious piece of spin.
Pavel, the media is very politically polarised in Poland. You have essentially to be, just like Francis at Demagogue, a friend to no one. You're in the business of putting the record straight and telling people when they've got it wrong. How do you handle Demagogue's position within the Polish media ecosystem?
The situation is very tense in Poland in terms of that. People tend to listen only to the media that is aligned to their ideology, to their political spectrum, to their political point of view. We are trying to build the bridges and not the gaps. We are trying to make this conversation between the media and also provide people with, you know, additional context and to encourage them even to read the media that they don't agree with in order to get better understanding of the situation and not fall into this, you know, rabbit hole, this information bubble. But it's hard.
Fact-checking as a professional practice has developed rapidly over the last few years. I mean, the pre-bunking work with Jigsaw and Google, for example, highly, highly professionalised and slick and looking very, very good. You've been in this field for 10 years now, Pavel. I mean, how has it changed both in Poland and in, you know, other European countries and your sort of international network?
Obviously, there was quite a huge development of fact-checking work in those years. We've actually developed very high level of standards for our work, international standards, both for International Fact-Checking Network, which is like the global organization that gathers all of the fact-checking community. And we have to adhere to basically prove ourselves that, you know, we are credible, we are transparent, we are non-partisan in our work. We are currently building a common repository facilitating by the, you know, European Fact Checking Standards Network, which is the Elections 24 check that gathers all of our fact checks, all of our work in the context of European elections, but also in the context of European Union in general. This is a very well-made repository that I all encourage to check. All of our organizations from the Europe are committing to this effort. Such cooperation, such projects were also present during the COVID pandemic. There was a Coronavirus Facts Alliance that was global collaborative work of all of the fact checkers around the world on COVID misinformation. With that kind of relation, with that support from other fact checkers from other countries, I think our work is much better, and we can also detect and track misinformation in a more effective way.
Do we need fact-checking? So in my opinion, especially in today's times, it's incredibly important because of the large language models and social media and uncensored, which is of course also good, but arises the risk that a lot of fake news is being published, and especially in politically, let's say, turbulent times, this might be quite a problem.
AI is producing whatever you need, whatever you want. That's the biggest, let's say, problem.
And now, no conversation about data can be complete without reference to artificial intelligence these days, especially as the problem of increasingly convincing so-called deep fake videos are now just part of the propaganda weaponry of political disinformation. Just before the European parliamentary elections, the European Commission's vice president and transparency boss, Vera Jourova, went so far as to ask European political parties to pledge that they would not use deepfakes in their campaigns. Pavel, could you just tell us a little bit about how AI, machine learning and so on, has impacted your work and the work of Demagogue? Can you just talk us through that?
Yes, everybody is talking about AI today, and all of the claims that AI will be replacing us, especially in the context of journalism, I think it's quite false. Because from my perspective, from my opinion, we are still years and years away from the point that AI will actually be able to assess the, for instance, very complicated political context of the situation in a way that only humans are capable of do right now. So obviously AI is or can be in the future very supportive of our work, can facilitate our work in various ways. But it will never replace us. It will always, in my opinion, be supplementary to the core work that we are doing. And I think that we are still far away from machines and AI taking over the world in terms of fact-checking.
Fantastic. Okay, Kirsten, you talked a little bit earlier about webinars on statistical and data literacy, helping people to kind of unpack number stories for journalists and things like that. So tell us a bit about how DStatis is helping to raise levels of data literacy, numeracy and statistical literacy.
We've done it for over 10 years, but we never called it data literacy or help against disinformation. This just came up the last years. As an example, we have quite a good e-learning on our website, which helped to get to a basic standard of knowing statistics. There's an advanced part for students, and we have webinars for journalists about how to avoid frequent mistakes. So very low level, very easy. It is for everyone just easy to get familiar with statistics and to increase statistical know-how.
Dean, the dissemination unit at Eurostat are the publicists of the organisation, effectively. Tell us a bit about how they communicate Eurostat's work, especially as it relates, again, to this thing called quality, which is so central to fact-checking and everything being completely correct.
The major way in which Eurostat disseminates its data is through the online database, the website, and various digital publications, which are designed to be user-friendly and easily accessible to a broad audience. And they include detailed metadata and methodological notes to provide context and enhance understanding of the statistics presented. Continuous improvement is another cornerstone of Eurostat's quality strategy, involving regular updates to methodologies, the adoption of new statistical techniques, and staff training so that staff stay abreast of best practices and technological advances. I should point out that when it comes to journalists, Eurostat provides a multilingual user support for everyone, but which journalists in particular can use to get answers to their questions about European statistics. And I should emphasize that Eurostat is part of the European Commission's efforts to tackle disinformation and foreign information manipulation. We've just had the European elections. And with regards to those, Eurostat set up a special data and fact-checking corner for the elections. It was available for a limited time period, and it served journalists and fact-checkers. It gave them answers about data and statistics on the EU. So when journalists and fact-checkers had questions, they could send an email to Eurostat and they received a quick response to their inquiry. So this was a service set up especially for the European elections.
Well, we're out of time, unfortunately. It just remains for me to say thank you very much to our wonderful guests. I'd like to say particular thanks to Pavel Topilovsky at Demagogue. Pavel, it's been great to have you on the show. Thank you for joining us.
It's been a pleasure, Jonathan.
Also, a big thanks to Kirsten Hansel from Destatis, the German Federal Statistics Office. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
And Francis Elliott, former political editor of The Times. Thank you, brother, for coming on and giving us the benefit of your wisdom. I wish we could have talked more.
I learnt a lot. Thanks a lot.
Fantastic. Okay. And finally, Dean Vuletic from Eurostat. Thank you very much also for joining us today.
Thank you, Jonathan. It's always a pleasure to be part of your podcasts.
And thank you, everybody, for a wonderful discussion. Very, very stimulating. If you've enjoyed Stats in a Wrap, don't forget to follow us on social media and share our adventures with friends and colleagues, where the show can be found on Spotify, Apple, Google, and all the usual places. And of course, join us for the next edition, when we'll be dishing up more flavoursome insights from Eurostat. This time, about how stats is being helped by technology, especially artificial intelligence, which also goes by the less glamorous name of, well, applied statistics. Join us then. But for now, goodbye.